This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Your source for Pan-African news and world developments, I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yves Wuhib, coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Firstly, Ambassador Weah needs to consolidate Liberians. First, they have a stable and peaceful nation. And then next, putting a sound economic policy in place.
That's the voice of Liberian man who urges Liberia's new president, George Weah, to focus on maintaining stability and building the economy. More details on the story coming up.
Also, at least six people died when police in the DRC fired on protesters yesterday. And Ethiopia is rejecting a call from Egypt for World Bank arbitration in their dispute over a Nile River dam it is building.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story, before a packed stadium, George Weah took the oath of office today as Liberia's new president. He replaces Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who served for 12 years as the nation began to heal from years of civil war. The ceremony marks the country's first peaceful transfer of power between democratically elected leaders in more than 70 years. Weah, an international football star, won 61% of the vote in the runoff election in late December. Journalist Moses Garzaiwo spoke with some Liberians ahead of today's inauguration ceremony. This woman calls for the new president to look after the interests of women.
There are a lot of things that the president soon to be can do for the women and girls of Liberia. George Mane Weah, president-elect and soon to be president, should prioritize the issue of farm to market rules, because women who are in rural areas, they depend on the produce from their farm to feed their families, buy uniform for their children and book bear and so forth.
And this man urges him to focus on maintaining stability and building the economy.
Firstly, Ambassador Weah needs to consolidate Liberians. First, they have a stable and peaceful nation. And then next, putting a sound economic policy in place. As you can see now, the rate has increased, and Liberians' lives, are deplorable. There should be a proper economic policy put in place to transform the lives of Liberians.
Liberia is one of the world's poorest countries, despite some gains made during the Sirleaf years. Many Liberians hope that Weah can build on the stability established during her administration to bring greater prosperity.
At least six people died when police in the Democratic Republic of Congo fired on protesters yesterday. The United Nations peacekeeping force says more than 50 were injured when police tried to break up protests in Kinshasa, Goma, and other towns. The Catholic Church organized the demonstrations to protest against President Joseph Kabila's rule. Kabila has been in office 17 years. His term was to have ended in 2016, but his government has yet to organize elections, blaming organizational problems. The violent Sunday prompted Pope Francis to call on the DRC authorities and all citizens to avoid all forms of violence and seek solutions for the common good.
Zimbabwe is on high alert following reports of a cholera outbreak that has claimed five lives. This comes at a time where one of the county's neighbors, Zambia, has been fighting a severe outbreak that has caused more than 70 deaths. Reporter Kuzayi Zvinovashi reports.
Zimbabwe's Minister of Health and Child Care, Dr. David Parerenyatwa, explained the outbreak.
A cholera outbreak has been reported in Chegutu municipality in Mashonaland West Province, and this was on the 18th of January this year. To date, there are 32 cases, 30 suspected and 2 confirmed cases, and 4 deaths reported.
UNICEF, the World Health Organization, and other humanitarian organizations have come in with significant resources to support the government as it addresses the outbreak. Parere Nyato says the origins of the outbreak are being investigated.
We think that the index case, when we say index case, we mean the first case, was an 8-year-old female who succumbed to the disease at home on the 8th of January this year. Subsequently, people who attended this funeral and other subsequent funerals linked the initial case, and people fell ill and started presenting for treatment at the hospital.
The minister said various steps have been taken to ensure cholera doesn't spread. Part of this is treatment camps in vulnerable areas, as well as supervised burials for the victims. Parere Nyato says a total of 34 people have been affected. He says municipalities need to address factors that create favorable conditions for outbreaks.
Chegutu municipality has a critical shortage of water due to aging water reticulation infrastructure like most towns in Zimbabwe. And this needs to be addressed, and needs to be addressed aggressively. There is a rampant vending in undesignated places, including selling of meat and fruits on pavements. People buy and eat all these on the streets in unhygienic conditions.
Parere Nyato is urging people to practice careful hygiene, such as washing hands before eating or after using the toilets, and refraining from shaking hands when greeting each other. For VOA, this is Kudza Ezinawashe from Harare.
Ethiopia is rejecting a call from Egypt for World Bank arbitration in their dispute over a Nile River dam that Addis Ababa is building. Cairo is concerned the dam will reduce water flows on the Nile and damage its agriculture. But the Ethiopian government says the hydropower dam is crucial to providing electricity to millions of its people. Officials in Addis Ababa say it will not harm water flows down the river. After his visit to Cairo last week, Ethiopian Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn Saturday rejected Egypt's proposal for a World Bank role. The Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam will more than double Ethiopia's electricity output. It is key to the government's plan to quadruple power production to reach millions of people now without electricity.
Power Africa, a U.S. government initiative to double access to electricity in sub-Saharan Africa, has launched a guide to community engagement for power projects in Kenya. The guide outlines how electricity producers can best engage with consumers. From Nairobi, Ruben Chama reports.
Kenya has a dynamic private sector-driven power industry, but community concerns have affected the completion of these projects. Robert Godek is the U.S. ambassador to Kenya.
There have been many development delays over time as a consequence of poor community engagement, and I think that this guide really does take a major step forward. It's going to help power developers create win-win situations where power project developers can, in fact, proceed, but communities really understand what is happening and really can get benefits. So I think that this guide to community engagement for power projects in Kenya is a big step forward, and I just want to congratulate everybody who's worked on it. It's an excellent resource, I think, for everybody involved.
The guide provides successful examples of infrastructure developers working with the community and overcoming hurdles and avoiding pitfalls at each stage of the project. Kevin Dole, a senior advisor at Power Africa Initiative, explains.
The most basic type of community engagement is when you inform a community of what you're doing. Okay, we're going to build this here, this road, this railway, this power plant, etc. The second next level is consult with them. So we're going to build this here. What do you guys think about it? The third part is involving them. So we're going to build this. What do you think about it? What can you contribute towards us planning this and thinking this through?
Developed with input from local communities, government agencies, private sector developers, financial institutions, and Kenyan and international civil society organizations, the guide is tailored to reflect country-specific laws, customs, and institutions that developers in Kenya must navigate. Andrew Kamau is Kenya's principal secretary at the Ministry of Energy and Petroleum. He says since 2013, the number of Kenyans who have access to electricity has grown exponentially.
In 2013, access to electricity in Kenya was below 30%. Since 2013, there has been an exponential growth in connectivity across the country. In just 5 years, we have more than doubled the connected customers from 2.2 million to 6.3 million. We will continue to partner with the private sector to deliver for our people through public-private partnerships.
In Kenya, the Power Africa Initiative is coordinated by the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, launched by former President Barack Obama in 2013 with an initial investment of $7 billion. The program aims to install 10,000 megawatts of new generation capacity, connect 20 million new customers, and improve electricity reliability across sub-Saharan Africa. Initially, Power Africa focused on 6 countries, Ethiopia, Ghana, Kenya, Liberia, Nigeria, and Tanzania. According to the U.S. officials, the initiative aims to attract private capital into energy projects in a region where foreign investors often shy away due to regulatory obstacles and risks. Dole says most of the issues are land-related.
And we all know land is a very emotive subject here in Kenya.
According to USAID figures, the initiative has attracted more than $52 billion in additional commitments, including $40 billion from private investors. Ruben Chama, VOA News.
An innovative global trade finance company is providing short-term financing for entrepreneurs in Africa who can't get money elsewhere to cover the cost of purchasing goods. Countable, a multinational technology and trading company headquartered in San Francisco, California, has offices in Mauritius, Kigali, Rwanda, Grand Cayman, and will soon open an office in Nairobi, Kenya. Chris Hale is CEO of Countable. He spoke with me about how his company is helping entrepreneurs in Africa make their dreams come true.
Countable is a global trade platform, and we offer a unique type of finance for entrepreneurs who are importing, where we buy goods on their behalf and help them execute on international trade deals.
What are the qualifications for getting financing, especially if an entrepreneur has been turned down by a bank?
We look at the trade transactions very differently. That we're not really assessing the creditworthiness of the entrepreneur. We're looking at the quality of their end customer, the quality of their supplier, and their ability to execute on the transaction. So we're able to look at the problem very differently than banks and assess those qualifications based on how well the deal will go and how likely we think it is to execute.
What would be an example?
We do a lot of work in IT. And so an entrepreneur wins a contract to build a data center for a bank, as an example. And they need to buy all the components of the data center, like, you know, switches and cabling and so forth. And the bank wants it to be first quality, top tier equipment, like Cisco, as an example. And so the entrepreneur has difficulty getting that financed because it's a large deal. Big companies like Cisco aren't going to ship to a small business without getting paid. And the bank won't pay until the project is complete. And so there's quite a lot of friction in that three-party transaction, but we understand it and can help make it run smoothly.
And how are you able to help finance these types of businesses?
So over the course of our lifetime as a company, the answer to that question was varied. But as of January last year, we secured a $150 million line of credit from an investment fund here in the United States. And so we use that capital to fund these projects.
When you're looking at entrepreneurs in Africa, what are some of their biggest challenges?
I think the biggest challenge these entrepreneurs in Africa face is anonymity. People have a lot of assumptions about what business is like in Africa, and frankly, those assumptions are often underdeveloped. And the entrepreneurs have no formal way to demonstrate their identity, both as a safe counterparty to work with and as a good business partner to engage with. And so our platform manages their identity and assesses their readiness for this project.
Can you give us an example of a success story from your experiences in working with African entrepreneurs?
Sure. One of my favorite recent success stories is we were contracted with a small entrepreneur that we've worked with on 5 different occasions now to procure almost $1 million worth of malarial test kits from a subsidiary of Abbott. That program is facilitated by the World Health Organization. So one would think that a project of this magnitude and importance would work a little bit better than it does. But even these really critical development projects face this problem, and it really gives us a lot of pride to be able to make those kinds of projects work better.
That was Chris Hale, CEO of the global technology and trading company Countable. He spoke with me from San Francisco, California. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 20 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Before a packed stadium, George Weah took the oath of office today as Liberia's new president. At least six people died when police in the DRC fired on protesters yesterday. And Ethiopia is rejecting a call from Egypt for World Bank arbitration in their dispute over a Nile River dam it is building. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
According to a global authority on endangered wildlife, nearly one-third of more than 85,000 animal species are in danger of extinction, among them African zebras and rhinos. Scientists and volunteer activists are increasingly using technology not only to keep them alive, but also to support procreation. VOA's George Putish reports.
The last living male northern white rhino in the world, named Sudan, enjoys 24-hour military protection in this wildlife conservancy camp in central Kenya. His weak hind legs prevent him from breeding naturally with one of the last two female white rhinos. Scientists would like to try artificial insemination, but the procedure is complex, dangerous, and costly. To raise money, the conservancy created an online app asking for donations. Elodie Sampere leads the fundraising campaign.
In terms of the money raised, we were aiming to raise about $1 million, and we raised about $85,000, which was a bit disappointing. We were really hoping to raise more money than that.
If they do, conservationists hope they will eventually raise 10 calves, creating a herd that can bring the species back from the edge of extinction. Another group in Kenya is trying to catalog all Grevy's zebras living in an area of about 200 square kilometers. Head of research and monitoring at Liwa Conservancy, David Kimiti, says the process starts with volunteer photographers taking photos of zebras, which are then fed into a computer.
It's a computational system that matches images from wildlife images for any wildlife that is striped, spotted or patterned in any other way, and it uses algorithms and grid-based image assessments to identify whether images are from the same animal.
The software creates an identity card for each animal and over time can show whether their number increases or decreases. It can also be used for cataloging other animals with unique patterns, such as giraffes that are also on the list of endangered species. George Putich, VOA News.
The UN Children's Fund warns that millions of Iraqi children affected by conflict and poverty face a grim future and are in desperate need of international support. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UN Children's Fund says that in Iraq, more than 4 million children, about one quarter of all Iraqi children, live in poverty. Most of these children, it says, are scarred by years of conflict and deprivation. The government has made great strides in bringing the fighting to an end in several areas of the country. But UNICEF notes children continue to suffer from ongoing violence, lack of education, and basic care. The city of Mosul is a notable example. Although Iraqi government forces have succeeded in driving the militant Islamic State group out of western Mosul, UNICEF says the after effects from this conflict linger on and continue to have a detrimental impact on children. UNICEF representative in Iraq, Peter Hawkins, says about 1 million children have fled Mosul. Speaking on a line from the capital, Baghdad, he tells VOA the many children who remain in the city face multiple risks.
The biggest threat to children in West Mosul, unquestionably, is unexploded ordnance, which are being cleared everywhere. We know that that is a perennial problem, one that perhaps will never, ever fully go away because of the sheer number of unexploded ordnances that scatter the western part of the city.
UNICEF reports poverty and conflict have interrupted the education for 3 million children across Iraq. It says some have never been inside a classroom, a situation that is likely to rob them of a meaningful future. The Children's Agency is calling on the international community to provide immediate and long-term investments in education. It says this will pay huge dividends in creating a brighter, more stable Iraq. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The U.S. Senate today voted for a temporary spending plan to fully reopen the federal government after a partial three-day shutdown. Senators approved legislation to keep federal agencies open through February 8th after Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell assured opposition Democratic lawmakers that he would, in the coming weeks, allow a vote on protecting about 800,000 young illegal immigrants from deportation. The Democrats had demanded firm assurances that the chamber would consider the fate of the immigrants who were brought into the U.S. years ago by their parents before agreeing to end the legislative standoff. Democratic leader Charles Schumer said McConnell assured him if the immigration issue was not resolved by February 8th, the Senate would immediately consider it right after that date. The legislation to end the shutdown must still be approved by the House of Representatives, but that is considered virtually certain before the measure is sent to President Donald Trump for his signature.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, a look at President Donald Trump's first year in office, his successes and setbacks. We'll also take a closer look at his agenda for the year ahead. Join us for the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.